Hello and welcome to Pedagodzilla, the pedagogic podcast with the pop culture core. So today I am, as usual, joined by my capable co-host.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Ferguson. I'm Professor Emerita at the Open University, and my title in this context is Innovator of Pedagogies.
Oh, and I should have said that my tagline for these months, while Mike is busy doing other things, is I am imposter syndrome incarnate, because it's actually taken me 20 minutes to get everybody onto the podcasting platform we use. So and also, today, we are joined by a very special guest, Richard.
Sure. I'm Richard Treves. I am the training officer at the River Restoration Centre, which is based at Cranfield University. And I'm a learning technologist, learning designer, and something of a geography specialist as well.
And the three of us all know each other, have all met up frequently through the Playful Learning Conference.
Yes, and that's what got me into embodiment in the first place, actually.
Which is a nice segue onto the question we're asking today, which is, does Stand By Me put us on the right track for embodied learning?
Part one, the question.
So, Richard is the person that suggested we look at embodied learning through Stand By Me. So, Richard, do you want to tell us, to kick us off, a bit about Stand By Me?
Yes, it's an 80s film. I think it's really a road movie without the car. They go on a journey, and the journey is the narrative. It's very sparsely shot. It's not big on wide open spaces and beautiful countryside. It's about people and their relationships. And as they walk through the countryside, these boys who are exploring the story, which is that there's a dead body and they want to go and see it. And they're 12 years old. Am I right? 12 years? Yeah. 12 years old. So they're just about to shift school. So it's sort of a coming of age movie as well. And there is a nice interaction with an older teenager when they actually find the body. And it's also, I think it's got a lot to do with Hero's Journey as well. It seems to follow that. Very popular film, 40 years old. Apparently the actors are out on a tour, the remaining actors who are alive, celebrating it. And I think it's going to get remade. So a bit of a classic.
Yeah, I think one of the resonances of the film is, you know, at the end you hear what happened to the four lads later in life. And I think because many of the people in this were famous actors, then there is added resonance in that. One of them's River Phoenix. River Phoenix died of a drugs overdose. The director was murdered recently. One of them had a big campaign about sexual abuse in Hollywood, says he was sexually abused as a child. So the sort of resonances of the actors with the films, which I think have kept it in the public eye, apart from the fact it's a good film, but I think that's been important as well.
Interesting. And yes, I hadn't thought about that, but that's probably why it's so popular, isn't it? It's been kept in the public eye rather than just being a cracking story.
Richard, is there any sort of bits that stood out for you? What kind of attracted you to the film?
It came out in the 1980s, isn't it? It's very 50s. Mm. So there's an initial kind of, oh, that's an interesting angle. Boys growing up in the 1950s. But the standout scenes are the train scene where they're crossing the bridge and they get chased off and almost killed because there's no space to get away from the train coming over. And that's very visceral. And going through the swamp and getting the leeches, that's also highly embodied disgust. Now, the first one is fear, and that's disgust. And that's when Gordy faints. And then the fireside sort of scene where Gordy and Chris kind of tell each other, oh, well, it's Chris, isn't it? Chris talks about the adult that let him down and stole from him, knowing that they could blame him. I thought that was very telling. And what was interesting about that was the whole way through the film, I thought the acting was incredible. I never thought there's child actors doing child acting, which is often something you get. It seemed authentic all the way through. But at that bit, I thought they've just almost died. There'd be a shock. There'd be talking. And it's one of those jarring moments in a film where it sort of jars and you go, they'd be talking about it. They wouldn't be talking about whether Goofy was a dog. So there's that. And then the end scene where I thought it was highly metaphorical is Ace tries to take the body and they're defending the body. And Chris stands up to him and it's sheer bravado and bravery, even though Ace has got a knife and is bigger than him. And then Gordy comes with the gun and he didn't seem to be prepared to shoot him. So those are the outstanding moment. But Rebecca, you noticed the lack of female figures in the whole film and the violence, just the violence of it all the way through as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I was struck by the sort of undercurrent of violence running through these lads' lives. And actually, you know, when we talked about it earlier, you were saying, well, you know, this is how it is at boys' school. You know, it is a feature of lads growing up. But I was very struck by, on their journey, they encounter lots of times when they could be badly hurt or killed. As you say, they could be killed by the train. And that is shot. It's one of those things where, like, they appear to be inches from the train for about 5 minutes or something. And that's very dangerous. Then you see the older teenagers, you know, they're sort of courting danger all the time. One of them is having the word vipers carved into his arm with a razor blade. They have this huge game of chicken on the road, which could easily result in their death. And in fact, Gordy's elder brother had died in a jeep accident earlier, so that could have been the same sort of thing. And then you sort of move up a generation and you see, you know, Teddy's father was fighting on the beaches in Normandy. He's come back with PTSD. He's really severely injured his son. He's in a mental home. Gordy's parents are absolutely traumatised by their son's death. And the film is sort of sandwiched between finding out about the ultimate death of Charlie when he's older. And that's because he's intervened in a knife fight, which is essentially what he does with Gordy and Ace at just before the end of the film. You know, he's the person who will go in and he's saved by Gordy when he's 12. But when he's in his early 30s, he's killed. So there's just all this death and violence throughout. And at the same time, there are no women's voices at all. The women are either not there, or like Gordy's mother is a character, but she never says anything. You know, that's an absolute feature of it, that, you know, she's ignoring him. She's really traumatized by his brother's death. So yeah, it's this very male culture. It's this very violent male culture, and perhaps it's, you know, specifically a post-war culture, because, you know, they're children who will have been born just after World War II.
Mm. So this is one of the kind of movies that were really standout that Rob Reiner did over that particular period, Princess Bride and this Spinal Tap being another couple. So, yeah, okay, so that's the Stand By Me. So let's move on to the second half of the question, which is embodied learning. Now, I thought when we were having a chat earlier, we'd start off with embodied cognition and then maybe talk about that. And then when we've done that, you know, talked about that a little bit, move into how that plays out in embodied learning. So do you want to tell us a little bit about embodied cognition, Richard?
Yes. As I understand it, it's been very interesting that philosophically, there's the whole argument about what can you really know about the world, and your senses could be lying to you and the world could just be invented. And so all you know is, I think, therefore I am. And that it's an interesting philosophical position to have, but it's had the effect of separating the mind from the body. And we think up here in our heads, and kind of our bodies lie to us, and they can't be trusted, and they're kind of machines for taking us around and doing us what we want. And recently, all kinds of science and brain studies and psychological experiments have shown that, in fact, it's much more meaningful to more holistically think of ourselves as us as bodies, as in the entire thing. That's us. And it's not you're a brain that happens to be in a meat machine. So that's the idea of cognition. And the one I really love, there's a number of examples of psychological experiments, is the one where they get children to do maths, and if you gesture, you're better at maths. You can do the maths better if you wave your hands around as you do it, which is like, that seems completely weird. But that's because Western culture has sort of led us down this path of believing that we're brains separated from bodies, and actually we think with our bodies. So that's what I sort of hold as embodied cognition.
My favorite example is they found that interviewers will rate interviewees more highly if they're holding a warm cup of coffee in their hands rather than a cold cup of coffee. So if you can go in for a job interview directly after the coffee break, you've got a better chance, basically, because the way that you feel, the way that you process things, all of that is modified by the fact that you're feeling comforted by this warm cup of coffee. Or data, if you give people data on a clipboard, they will rate the data as having more authority if the clipboard is heavier.
Really?
Yeah. Because again, it's got more weight physically, yeah, and that's affecting the way the brain's processing and perceiving the world and perceiving the actual numbers on that. That's,
yes, it's worth more. It's like having more apples in your hands or something, isn't it?
Yeah. So, Rebecca, is there something you wanted to add about cognition before we move on to learning specifically?
Well, you did point me to a paper about embodied cognition in which the author sort of looks at different aspects of the ways in which people understand cognition as being embodied. So we could just run through some of those. The first one she identified is the idea that cognition is situated. She says that assumes that it always takes place in a real-world environment that is inherently going to involve perception and action. I think that's one of the ones that definitely Mark and I would be most dubious about, you know, having done a lot of work in virtual reality. Does all cognition take place in a real world environment? Surely a lot of learning, a lot of thinking is done aside from any immediate interaction with the environment. You know, I could be thinking about something I'm going to do in 3 weeks' time, or I could be thinking about something I did 6 years ago, and that could be going on in my head while I'm doing something entirely different.
That situated kind of understanding, they have done experiments and they've proved this. And obviously it's just an effect size. It's not the total. And you're quite right. What's going on in your brain? You could be thinking about somewhere entirely different. I'm often thinking about Hawaii because I spent some time there. It's a lovely place. So I'm in there in my head. But on average, people are affected by where they are. They've done experiments. They took people to the bottom of the ocean. They taught them to remember some words. Then they tested them at the bottom of the ocean. They tested them on the beach. And if you're being tested in the same place that you're being taught, you do better. So environment does affect you, and it's just a measurable size. So some people have done worse and some people will have done better.
Okay, anything else that you stood out from that paper then about the different categories, Rebecca, of embodied cognition?
Okay. She says another aspect of it is the idea that cognition is time pressured, and we ought to understand it in terms of the pressures of real-time interaction with the environment. Another point is the idea that we offload cognitive work onto the environment. So this comes back to the sort of limits of our working memory, ideas about cognitive load. You can't think about too much at one time. So we use the environment to hold information for us or to manipulate it. She says Another idea is the environment is part of the cognitive system. We're not really separate from the world. Our mind and our body are in the world. Are we a mind and a body, or are we a mind and a body in a world, or where are the boundaries? And cognition is for action. The idea that, why have we got a mind? Well, it's to guide action. So we ought to understand everything we're doing in terms of situation appropriate behaviour. And the final point she made was the idea that cognition is body-based. Even if we're online and we don't think we're interacting physically, everything our mind is doing is grounded in things that evolved for interacting with the physical environment.
Having been in online learning for 30 years odd, the finding that actually writing on a bit of paper is better for taking notes. It just goes against the grain of every... I keep on rolling my eyes at people who say, oh, I need to write on a bit of paper. Just type it and then you can search it. It's obviously much better. But there is something physical about that. So even when you're doing something, you know, it's not high bandwidth in terms of what you're doing. It's not running away from a train on a bridge. You're just writing something, but it seems to have an effect. Is the feel of the pen and the feel of the paper somehow is better than actually typing it electronically onto a screen.
That's true. We did some work around whether students wanted to have sort of physical copies of things, and they identified lots of advantages to physical copies. There's a lot of a sort of effective elements. Like, there were several people who said, well, when I start a new course, it's an excuse to go to the stationery shop. So I go to the stationery shop and I buy, you know, lovely new stationery and folders and things. And that's really exciting. And it marks the beginning. And they're going, yeah. And at the end of a course, I've probably got piles of paper all over the place. And I go and I clear them away. And that marks, you know, I've done it. I've learned it. That's all there. And there was lots of sort of writing things on post-it notes and physically arranging them and rearranging them. So even though we did this research with online learners who, you know, there was absolutely no reason whatsoever for them to have physical copies of the materials if they didn't want, they came up with lots and lots of reasons why they found it useful and why they found it supported their thinking.
I remember doing a really difficult course at university, my undergrad, and thinking, I'm going to fail this course unless I do something radical. So I didn't do this with most of my courses, but I bought myself a nice hardbacked A4 book, and I got my scruffy notes because I'm terrible at note taking. And I went home after every lecture and related the lecture notes to a textbook, and I wrote it up neatly in the book, and there was a sort of formal, this is what I do with this course because otherwise I'm going to fail it, and I got one of the best marks in the cohort. And that was, I kind of tied it in with that ceremony of, oh, now I'm going to open the big nice book, and that's kind of, and it's the extended mind idea, is this is my mind, I've now organized it, I've now conflated these different sources of information, put them together, and here they are nicely arranged in my brain, which happened to be a hardback nice book. So I can totally relate to what they're saying there. But there was another experiment which is still freaking me out a bit, trying to work out what's going on, is they got people, children, language learning, moving little figures around. So Farmer Brown goes to his tractor and he gets out his pumpkin, and they're actually moving figures around, little Lego figures, and they learn better than if you just teach them without involving that model. But you can also get people to do it electronically, moving a little model on a screen, and you get much the same effect. So it is kind of embodied without being embodied. It's thinking in an embodied way is actually better than just theoretical thinking inside your head, which is weird.
Well, it's kind of like the method of loci, isn't it? Where you sort of imagine that you're in different parts of your mind palace or whatever, and then link different ideas to that. The actual memory, although it's intangible, the memory or the thought of moving within a space taps into that whole hippocampus, three-dimensional location, embedded in a different space kind of idea, which then enables you to draw on that aspect of cognition when you're trying to remember stuff. Mm. The other things you mentioned there, I think two things. One is the role of ritual, and one of the things that the OU students often talk about is the ritual of opening the box with the books that they get from a course, and about how grounding that is. And I think there's something grounding about physicality, that ritual, all those sorts of things, I think, are reassuring. And I think that affective thing is something that this embodied cognition ties into. And the other one, the thing that you said about the note-taking is, and this is why people have theorized that writing notes works better, is because it's slower. So you have to abstract the information a little bit more before you write it down. You can't, if you're trying to transcribe everything a lecturer says, you're not going to cope. But if you're thinking about what that person said and then capturing the key parts of it and then writing those down, you've already started processing it to some extent, and so therefore that helps with the learning.
Yeah, summarising being good learning.
Yeah. I think when we were doing talking before the show started, the recording started, you mentioned about how this is important for you, Richard, with fieldwork, and about how fieldwork ties in with this. And Rebecca's already mentioned art and music in our chat. So do you want to tell us about embodied learning and how all this cognition stuff plays out in your approaches to pedagogy?
Yes. Well, it's interesting about teaching in the field, and we sort of touched on cognitive load. And I've recently been thinking about this, and I think it's very cognitive load orientated, is that we've made a great success of having a blended learning course where students interact in Moodle for 4 weeks, learning the theory, doing self-assessment questions, classic distance learning stuff, and then they come in the field. And the cognitive load is we've made it theoretical. It's, you know, line diagrams, this is what a river's doing. And then they come in the field and it's the messy world, and there's plants in the way, and you've got to push the plants out to see the river, and you can't see the sediment unless you poke it with a stick. And they've got to see past that and now apply their knowledge in the messy world. But it's much better than trying to teach them straight away in the world, because if you take them out into the messy world, they're kind of overloaded with this stuff. But there is a huge amount of stuff in the embodiment. So I think you came out in the film is the community, it's their social interactions are all guided by their journey. And I started my teaching career at Sunderland University, teaching geology, and we took the students out on an enormous number of field days. I think they had 100 a year. And the retention, I think it was somewhere about 85% would make it through the first year. We had 100%. And that I put that down to the social thing, is they get on a bus all the time with each other. They sit and they eat their sandwiches on the way to the field trip before they got there. And they drink their coffee and they chat to each other. And then they get out in the rain and they have to suffer as they do in the film. And it brings them really closely together. And they're a cohort and they support each other and they feel tied into the course as a result. And they stick with it. So there's the social side of teaching in the field that really has something. And then there's also something about that whole, the environment, is being in the environment, learning about a river, for example. When you're standing on a river, the evidence seems to show that if you go to another river, now you'll be able to unpack that knowledge because you've learned a river A and now you're applying it to river B. Again, being in online learning, people say to me, would say to me over the years, is you have to go and see the river. You have to go and see, and I'm going, but you're just popping out of a bus. It's taking you half an hour to get there. Then you walk down, you see one view of a river up and down. You can't see much. I can put you in Google Earth and show you in three dimensions this river all the way up and down. But they seem to be right, is that actually there is something very compelling and memorable about actually going to the place and it experiencing it. And loads of my colleagues would say exactly the same, who do field teaching. So, and it's not just rivers, it's all this stuff, it's geology, biology stuff that I've been involved with.
I was thinking some disciplines are, you know, almost completely embodied. Like if you're learning to play the piano, yeah, of course you need to know musical theory, but you're probably going to be relating musical theory to actually playing and what that looks like on the piano. If you're doing sports, yes, you need to know the theoretical stuff about you know, nutrition and how your muscles work. But a lot of it is just going to be doing the sport. The same with art. So all these things have theoretical components, but mostly you're not going to get very far unless you're doing the embodied aspect of it. And I was thinking, well, yeah, does this apply to, say, maths? But when you think about maths at primary school, I think schools would try to teach mathematical concepts with physical things. So basic algebra would be with beads on a string to represent things, using an abacus, or counting physical things and then moving the physical things around, adding them up, subtracting them, before they move on to the idea that, you know, these are abstract things you might do in your brain. And as we were saying earlier, people still find it easier often to do maths by waving their hands around or a little bit of counting on their fingers. So you're using your body to do those things. I mean, it's probably not the case when you get onto higher and further maths, but I never got to those, so I can't tell you.
Let's move from that on to the next part of the show, where we look at answering the question.
Part two, the answer.
Okay, so here's the question. Does Stand By Me put us on the right track for embodied learning? So how do, I think, Richard, you've touched on this earlier, but how do the four boys or anyone else in the movie, how does their movement, how does that field trip that they've got to dead body field trip, how does that indicate embodied learning?
I think it is. I don't think it's the whole story, though. I think as a way of opening up people's conversation, which is a sort of social thing about embodied learning, being in a place makes you a different person. And that's the environment. And it's within the whole film, is they're going outside the town to find out what they feel about the town. I think that shows that really beautifully. In terms of how their journey affects them, it makes them unpack their feelings and their thoughts, and that's the physical thing. And they learn to conquer their fear, and one of the things I took away from it is just how brave they are. Is they're not that old. They've gone through all this stuff. They're going on a long physical route march with not very much food. They've conquered their hunger, they've conquered their fear, they've conquered their disgust. They're learning that they can do this without adults, which is a recurring theme in films. So I think it does illustrate certain aspects of it. In terms of embodied learning, in terms of learning something like how to drive a car, well, they don't end up with specific skills that they didn't have before, really. It's the environment that's having the effect. So I think it's showing some, but there's a whole thing about learning to do things. And we've touched on that. We're talking about music and talking about recognizing and interpreting landscapes and all those sort of things that it doesn't really dig into. So yes, it does. I would think it does some parts of it. Other parts of it, it doesn't.
I suppose it's that's the thing that you do with field trips, is it reframes everything because you're out of your normal environment. Because so much of learning is embodied within the environment itself, situated in that way. By moving us from that and putting us into a different space, you've kind of reset everything, haven't you? You've given an opportunity to begin from scratch and rethink things and look at stuff from a distance. And this is why we have away days. It's not just a little jolly away from things. It's to get us out of the office environment and somehow reset a lot of those dynamics, because we're not in our usual situation, because it resets a lot of those connections between people. And I guess that's what's going on in an embodied way in Stand By Me. And not only once, but constantly, because they're on the move, because it's, you know, a track across the whole thing. It's like each scenario gives them a different way to be embodied and lose that previous embodiment and gain another one as they're moving through. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, so, okay, I think it does then. Stand By Me does put us on the right track for embodied learning. So I think we've answered the question there. So let's now move on to the final section, which is tips for your own practice. This is going to be an interesting one.
Part 3, practical tips.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about embodied cognition and embodied learning. How do you apply this to other disciplines? So I think geography, geology, biology, those are all pretty obvious. Art and music, I think, as Rebecca was saying, it's intrinsic to those. But if you're teaching some other discipline that doesn't obviously have embodiment within what's being learnt, how do you approach embodied learning? How is it important for what you're doing?
This is something I'm doing in my playful learning session this year. Is you can obviously, as you say, Mark, things like biology, geology, and geography, it's got obvious avenues, but graphs and graphics can be brought into almost everything. So the example I'm going to talk about is, can you think about a Shakespeare play in terms of the relationships, in terms of a sort of a graphic of the connections between people? And if you do that and you get people to form a big graphic by wandering around, that's certainly different. It's certainly going to raise people's interest. They go, oh, what's happening now? Which is instantly more memorable, which is a good thing in learning generally. And then I think there might be some meat on the bones as well, because they're using their bodies. I think it might be just more memorable because of that. And when I've used graphs in a scientific way, what you can then do is have a conversation with someone. Is someone standing on their own? You say, I'm not picking on you, because that's a bit unfair, but would you like to tell us why you're out there away from everyone else? Because everyone else seems to be thinking something different. So you can do something social and mixed and physical by getting them to do a graphic of some kind and standing where they think they would be on the graphic.
So it's got that sort of spatiality to it, which is another way in which we make sense of the world around us, is our distance from things or our location within a space and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, so basically what you're talking about here is a whole set of different techniques or approaches that anyone who wanted to think about different ways to embody learning as a specific activity could adopt and incorporate and go, oh, we could do this in this one way. Mm. Is there anything that needs to be thought about in general about embodiment?
Well, there's two things I immediately reach for. Is I was talking to my mother-in-law about this, and she was a nursery teacher. And I said, you know, you must have incorporated play and physicality. And she said, oh, yeah, all the time. And she said, you're talking to them sometime and they're just drifting off. And she said, what I would do is get them to do things like clap their hands or stand up and turn around. And then she said their concentration came back. And she, you know, this isn't taught as a technique, but a lot of her colleagues discovered this and did this anyway. So physicality comes into that set of learners because their concentration is just so short, because they're very young. And also just being physical before teaching older school kids has been shown to be beneficial. So that whole, there's a whole sort of folk knowledge about this, is let's have a break, let's go for a walk, let's have a walk around outside. And I think you're reinvigorating yourself, and you're right, is that physicality is helping you, and part of it is a mental resetting, and part of it is just kind of activating your body and using it puts you in a better frame of mind for study and work.
Because if it makes you laugh, you've got more oxygen through, it lifts you, that resets. I've got a colleague that I think she gets students, and we were talking about, you know, undergraduates doing the birdie dance or something like that at one stage through the lecture. So she gets them all up and they do the birdie dance.
Yeah.
You know, the one where you pretend to flap your wings and all that, that one. And it works. They're a lot more attentive. They all have a laugh. They have a bit of a chat. The energy levels rise. And then they're back into studying law or whatever it is. But they're a lot more attentive because She's taking care of the bodies. You know what I mean? She's allowed them to be bodied for a certain period.
I think that's from a practical teaching point of view, that is a good thing. You've got to sell it. Because someone is going to give you feedback in your feedback at the end of the session. What were you messing around with that? I wanted to be taught law. And actually taking that 5 minutes is better for their learning, but you've got to sell it, which is where sort of meta teaching comes in, because I more and more in my practice, I tell people what I'm doing. Right. Yeah. I'm going to get you to do this strange thing. I'll explain why in a second. Then they do it. And then I say, I got you to do that because I think it helps with that. Tell me whether it worked or not in the feedback, but that's why I do it. And people will give you enormous leeway if you say, I'm trying to help you. The research says that this should help. I don't know. In this case, let's give it a go. That really helps with people. But you have to sell it, because otherwise people will bite your head off and say, I was here to learn law and you stopped me.
Yeah, transparent pedagogy all the way. Yeah.
Yes.
Considering how our learning environments are not designed doing embodied learning. I mean, they are in some subject areas. Obviously, if you're learning woodwork or metalwork or you're on an apprenticeship, yes, it is. But so often you're put into a lecture theatre and you're going in thinking, I want my students to be embodied, but they're all having to sit in rows facing me. Or, even if you go into a seminar room and you're thinking, oh, we'll have a good discussion, but it's all set up so it's in rows facing the front. And so it's useful to have some techniques for coping with that and bringing in embodiment. We've done some of those at Playful Learning conferences, the idea that you have online quizzes so that people are interacting across the room and competing across the room, paired exercises so that you're at least communicating with the person next to you. We have one where you were putting things onto paper aeroplanes, so you have to make the paper aeroplane, write on it and throw it. And we did that in a conference keynote panel recently. And now that is fixed in people's mind as, they'll go, oh, that panel where we all threw paper aeroplanes. So I think it's not just the physicality, it's the fun, which I think we're seeing coming up a lot when we're talking about this. It's the pleasure, it's the affective element of it that is not just that people are moving and embodied, but they're enjoying moving and being embodied. Because I think sometimes you can force embodiment on people and they're not enjoying it. Like if you go on an away day and they go, right, you're all going to go down the zip line, and there's 20% of the people going, I don't want to go down the zip line. I'm just rooted to the spot. So it's thinking about what people will enjoy, what they'll engage with.
And you're quite right. I think being physical is also fun. It's just natural. We're evolved to wander around and mess around. So it's natural and it appeals to someone, but you can easily go over the line and have someone disagree with you, quite strongly.
Yeah. I think another thing is recognizing bodies in online seminars. We're all sat online seminars for like an hour until, everything's clenched. And that's always a mistake. So giving people a break, giving them activities which take them away from the screen is always important, because I think that moves us around. It's actually it's a health and well-being thing as well. I'll big up Rebecca here, because I remember one of the online seminars Rebecca did where you got us all doing yoga. So we all had to lie on the floor. We didn't have to, but she's saying, I'm just doing a 5-minute presentation here. So rather than sit and look at the screen, you can hear me and lie on the floor. And if you've got a yoga mat, lie on your yoga mat and do some yoga. And that was, anyway.
It will have been another range of suggestions rather than you all have to go do yoga now.
Well, I was just going to say it's a million miles away from the sit up straight in the classroom, pay attention.
Oh, yeah.
It's diametrically opposite to that terrible teaching.
Okay. I think that's I think there's some really useful things there. So, okay, I'll wrap it up now. Just before we all say goodbye at the end, Richard.
Well, you can find about me and stuff I do on LinkedIn mostly at the moment. Yeah.
Okay. Rebecca, anything you wanted to talk about?
You can find me on LinkedIn, or you can find me on Blue Sky.
Oh, yes. And you have it's a Rebecca, but with a 3 instead of an E, isn't it? So something like that.
Yeah. 3 instead of the first name. Rebecca Ruff.
Brilliant. Okay. And I am Mark Charles on Blue Sky. Straightforward. And so I think we'll round it up. Okay. So thank you for listening. You can find us on pedagodzilla.com. You can find us on all your regular feeds. So thank you and goodbye from me.
Yeah, and goodbye from me.
And me.